Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Today's episode of All of It, like every show, is dedicated to the arts and culture and the culture. But today we're doing something a little bit different. We're collaborating with our friends at New York Magazine to bring you an entire show dedicated to those best of, year-end, top 10 lists we all know and love. Earlier in the show, we talked about the best episodes of TV of this year, the best movies, best albums. We took your calls. We're going to continue to do so. Our phone lines are wide open all hour. The number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We want to take your calls for your best ofs. We are now turning our attention to books because now is the perfect time of year to catch up on some of the reading that you might have missed earlier in the year. Joining us in the studio is Maris Kreisman, books contributor for Vulture, to talk about her favorite. You can find her monthly dispatches on books you should be reading them at vulture.com. Maris, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. You blew my mind when you said that you read more than 100 books this year.
More than 100 books that came out in 2018.
Oh my goodness.
And I barely made a dent.
But you have a few for us.
Yes, I do. Right.
Topping your list is Severance by Ling Ma.
Yeah, this is a debut novel that I had no idea about at the beginning of this year. And it's a wide variety of genres. It's part workplace novel and part woman coming of age in New York City, and then part post-apocalyptic zombie novel, too.
Well, then there's that. I understand. You know.
Yeah.
You see those all the time.
Absolutely. And she does every single one of those elements really well.
Oh, that's so interesting, because sometimes when people try to be inventive and do something that's never been done before, you think, oh, there's a reason this has never been done before.
Absolutely.
What is it about her writing that makes it work?
I think she's so good at getting the minute details about the drudgeries of every day that you can kind of really buy into the more fantastical elements.
You're next on your list. This one had a lot of buzz. I've heard about this one. There, There by Tommy Orange. It was in your roundup of the 18 books we can't wait to read this summer.
Yes.
It's another debut.
It is another debut, and it's another book that proves that there's still a lot of new things that can be done in books. And this one is about, it's told from the point of view of a bunch of people who are attending a powwow in Oakland, California. It's for indigenous Americans to meet and revel in their culture. But of course, his characters also face problems that plague the rest of America and are even worse so given the legacy of colonialism in America. So there's gun violence and alcoholism and opioid addiction. And it comes all together explosively.
And I'm interested because it's really about urban Native American lives.
It is. It's about Oakland. There's no reservation in this book.
All right. You also loved Alexander Chee's essay collection, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel.
Yes.
He had a very popular book.
Queen of the Night.
That's it, yes.
Yes. So he wrote that huge, I think it was almost 1,000 pages. And this is more of a collection of essays. Kind of one of my favorite subgenres is the writer's memoir, books that kind of explore not only how to write, but kind of how to live, how to be. And Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott and On Writing by Stephen King are part of those books. And this is the latest one that you need on your shelf.
Now, does this have any relationship to that 1,000-page book at all?
A little bit. It's more the autobiographical novel that Alex wrote was his debut that came out, I think, 20 years ago or so. So there's a lot about
that. So it called
all
the way back to that?
Yeah, it
did. Oh, that's interesting.
And it sort of, you know, goes through his career and how he grew as a writer.
We're talking to Maris Kreisman, who is a books contributor for Vulture. She's telling us about her favorite books of 2018, and she read over 100 of them, more than 100 of them. So they've got to do something special to be on this list. If you'd like to call in and let us know what were your favorite reads this year, what book couldn't you put down, what book did you recommend to all of your friends, 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. I meant to ask you this at the top. I've been asking everyone who's come in, what does your blank music, movie, TV, what does a book need to make it onto a Maris list?
It needs to be written in a way that takes me away somewhere I've never been before.
oh my gosh, that's such a succinct answer. It's like, take you away. I mean, just in terms of your imagination.
Absolutely.
In terms of-
yeah, yeah. And I think that could be any genre. I always love to look out for new voices, though.
That's interesting, because we had the gentleman from, I'm blanking his name, but New York Times top 10 books, and almost half of those books were debuts. I'm wondering what is going on in publishing that we're seeing these kind of extraordinary debuts. What do you see?
I think that for too long, we were limited in terms of what kinds of books would be published and what kinds of authors we considered to be part of the canon. And now the world is opening up a little bit more, and I hope it just continues to. I hope we continue to find more diversity in publishing houses as well as in authors, and it can only get better from there.
All right, let's take another look at another book. This one has a whole story. There's a whole mythology around, not mythology, it's a true story around this. I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
Yes.
All right, Michelle McNamara.
So this is a true crime book that is kind of about the author's own obsession with this serial killer who was terrorizing large swaths of California for over a decade in the 70s. And also how she kind of became fascinated with him and who this person could be. She did so much research, and she lays it out so well. And she also is very good at describing the crimes accurately. It's disturbing, but it's never lurid. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that. And then tragically, she passed away before the book had come out. And then there's a kind of like funny little twist is that the book came out, and then 2 or 3 months later, the man known as the Golden State Killer was finally apprehended thanks to DNA testing and maybe a little help from the author.
That's amazing. And we should mention that she was married to Patton Oswalt. And
yes.
They were just, I mean, some of the tributes he wrote to his wife. And she died suddenly, and it was
unexpectedly.
And some of the tributes that he wrote to her were so beautiful. And I'm sure he was instrumental in making sure that this got published.
And he does write the afterword in the book. So, yeah, I think he's all over it.
Now, Vulture reported that HBO might develop this. Is
this
true?
I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll keep our
fingers crossed.
And actually, I skipped over one book. I'm sorry.
That's
you looked
okay.
at me funny, like, wait, what's happening? Because this is a book we actually talked about before we went on air, that this has been on my reading list, and I just haven't gotten to it. My Year of Rest and Relaxation.
Yes, this is a new novel by Otessa Moshfegh. And if you hear the description and it sounds terrible and off-putting, don't be put off. It's about a woman who is narcissistic and privileged and who wants to take a year off of life for a year of R&R. And basically she does so by taking enough drugs to have kind of a sleep cure. And it's dark, but it's also very eventful. You would not think that in a novel where sleeping is the main goal.
And it takes place in New York City, right?
Indeed.
So how does action happen if she's completely doped up? And
there are moments of being awake, and then there are moments of lucidity, not always at the same time.
I need to write that down. You're a writer, aren't you? Let's go to line number 2. Kathy from Montclair is calling us. Hi, Kathy. Kathy, you there?
In the Window by A.J. Finn, which I really liked.
Woman in the Window, it's called?
Yep.
What's it about?
It's a mystery, very Hitchcockian, and was just one of these lovely books that I started the year off with and just stayed with me for the rest of the year. So,
all right, Kathy.
Mystery.
Mysteries will do that to you. Kathy, thank you so much. Let's go to line 1, Julie in Leonia, New Jersey. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great.
Oh, I'm so excited for your show. I think it's awesome.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm actually in a book club. We're on our 75th book, and we meet every second Friday of the month. And we've been meeting for about five or six years. We're the Leonia Ladies Literacy Legion.
Do you have capes? You should have capes.
We have wine. We have the food of the book. We have a group discussion for about an hour and a half. For instance, when we did Sinatra's 100th anniversary, we all dressed in black dresses and had champagne. And tonight's book is Less, about Arthur Less, an author himself. And my favorite book, though, is All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
And what about it?
I just love the fact that it was sad that, you know, first that the girl was blind, but that you really felt like you could feel yourself in this city during the war, and how exciting it was and just the feeling that you, if you're blind, you know, how you can survive through so much, and how the father helped her through everything, and what she became a professor later in life.
Julie from Leonia, thank you so much. I don't know you, Maris. I want to hang with Julie in the
absolutely
Leonia League of awesome ladies.
Wine and some awesome ladies.
Let's go to Anne in Chelsea on line 3. Hi, Anne. Are you there? I can see on the call screen what Anne read. So, Anne, are you there?
Hear me?
I hear you now. Yes.
Hi. Allison, you're wonderful. I love the show. Omarosa's book, Unhinged, and Lisa Brennan Jobs' book, Small Fry. Both two strong women telling their truths about two very complicated men. I thought both books were fabulous.
I love that you went for the juicy nonfiction, Anne.
Every American should read Omarosa's book.
All right, Anne from Chelsea, thank you so much for the recommendation. We're talking to Maris Kreisman, books contributor for Vulture. She's filling us in on her favorite books from the year. At number 6, you have Riddance by Shelley Jackson.
Yeah, this is one that might be a little under the radar, but it's one of those big doorstop kind of books that you can really immerse yourself in. And it's unsettling and weird in the best way. It's a novel set at a vocational school for children who receive elocution lessons, not to get rid of their stutters, but to use the space between the words to channel the dead, as one does. So you kind of sit in as these children study the science of necrophysics, is what it's called, and using language to narrow the distance between the worlds of the living and the dead. And it's accompanied by spooky old sepia-toned photos and diagrams and a fictionalized academic's notes. So it's so fun and sort of academic and silly at the same time.
I love, you have really blown my mind. Every book you've mentioned has had something so out there, and I mean that in the best way, that, you know, I don't know, but you'd probably see this. You look through bookshelves and you really appreciate that people put all this time and energy into a
absolutely
book.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they're blood, sweat, and tears. But you think, I've seen this before. Or this is so reminiscent of X, Y, or Z. You've presented us with a whole bunch that are
out
there.
You know, I heard that Shelley Jackson, the author, kind of invented her own little language that the students speak. So, yeah, I think the world that she built is huge.
And the last one on your list is Impossible Owls by Brian Phillips.
Yeah, this is an essay collection. Brian Phillips was a journalist at Grantland and at MTV.
Whoop, whoop. Sorry.
And yeah.
Well, shout out to my old peeps.
And he has an amazing way of taking readers to entirely unfamiliar places, like in nature, like the Yukon, or in culture, like a sumo wrestling match. And he translates these experiences into something that feels visceral, even for people who are stuck at their computers all day, which is how I first read his work.
Oh, excellent. Let's take one more call. I think we have time. Tom from Staten Island. Hi, Tom. What were you reading this year? Tom, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I hear you perfectly. What were you reading this year, Tom?
I was reading Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine. And by Gail Honeyman.
And what's it about? What's it about?
It's a wonderful book about a middle-aged woman who works in an office, and she has all of this history that you slowly learn throughout the book, and it starts to unfold as you're reading. And I just loved it because it makes you realize how little details, little things that other people can do can mean the world to other people, and you sort of really feel for this character as you go through the book, and it was just a wonderful read. I highly recommend it.
Tom from Staten Island, thanks for calling in. Do you know the book, Mars?
Indeed.
And what did you think of Tom's description? Was it accurate?
Absolutely. And I know that Reese Witherspoon is a big fan.
Oh, yeah. She is snapping up books
she sure is. Yes.
What do you think of that? I'm just curious.
Anything that gets more books into more hands is great.
I think she's kind of an interesting
person.
I think she's very smart. Was there anything we missed or something that you just sort of debated about being that last book or those last couple?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few. I want to mention Asymmetry by Lisa Halliday. It's a book told in three parts, and the first part is very good, and then the second part is amazing. And then in the third part, you kind of figure out how it's all interconnected.
Because the first two parts are really different.
Very, very different.
Okay. Maris Kreisman's Books You Should Be Reading articles are available at vulture.com. Maris, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to All of It on WNYC, and this is the New York Magazine All of It crossover show. We're getting the lowdown on the top critics' picks from our friends at New York Mag and Vulture, and we're taking your calls as well. After the break, senior art critic and Pulitzer Prize winner Jerry Saltz will share his thoughts on the best art shows of 2018. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Next up in our collaboration with New York Magazine is the Best Art Shows of 2018, brought to you by the one and only Jerry Saltz, a Pulitzer Prize winning art critic and friend of the show.
Hi.
I like that you did your queen wave.
Well,
that's awesome.
That's me.
In the last year, he's been featured in the documentary The Price of Everything and was also on the cover of New York Magazine. We are so glad you are here. Hey, listeners, if you want to weigh in, did you see a terrific art show this year? We do want to hear about it. Give us a call. Shout it out. 212-433-9692. WNYC. Jerry, you sat down, you said, number one is Hilma af Klint. She's a fabulous woman. I need to tell you about it. Tell us about number one. Let's just go to the top.
Well, let's do this thing. Hilma af Klint, 19th century born, Swedish visionary, who, it turns out, made the first large-scale, totally non-objective, abstract paintings made in modernist art history. So our whole history has been, in the beginning, there was Cézanne, who begat Picasso, who begat Matisse, who begat Duchamp, yada, 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 up to de Kooning, Pollock, and other men. Suddenly, out of nowhere, because she deemed that her work never be seen until 20 years after her death, we see this Swedish visionary at the Guggenheim, and it's extraordinary.
And her personal story is fascinating, that she when you say visionary, you mean she had visions that she should paint.
The real thing, you're absolutely right. She was meeting with a group of other women in Sweden. She's not out of it. She was given a studio at their academy. This is where Edvard Munch showed, downstairs from her studio. So she's not like some weird loser from Sweden. She and her women friends began having seances, and spirits started speaking to them, and she was commissioned by two of these spirits to do an enormous, gigantic cycle of paintings, and she did it. So before Mondrian, before Kandinsky, before Rodchenko, 10 years before, you have this woman making these enormous geometric kind of looping. They look like squid tentacles, sponges, triangles in beautiful prismatic color. And they're great. They're not just art to add to the canon because, you know, nudge, nudge, she was a woman. These are the real deal. And you know what it means? It means that art history is open. It's not a closed book. The canon is totally in play. I'm from the Garden of Eden, MoMA. I worship there, as painful as it is spatially these days. And now we know we can take that canon, set it to the side, and include whole new groups of people. And I promise you, not to keep yammering on about this, that within 5 or 10 years, we'll push back abstraction another 5 or 10 years to have begun formally, that is, in the 19th century. Really, it goes back to the caves, but that's a technicality.
Isn't it exciting to think of the canon as a living, breathing thing now, instead of something that is calcified and put in stone, and that is that, and that's the way it's written, and that's the way it shall be?
You should write that as the blurb for the canon, because it is so perfect, and it's like, oh, it's alive. We don't just have to worship Mount Everest and K2, that artists are coming in from outside. There was another great show that I didn't get to see called Outliers, and it was about outsider artists, people like Bill Traylor, a former slave. Right. He might have been America's greatest pre-war artist. He should have a postage stamp, United States Post Office, if you're listening. Really, for real. Martin Ramirez, Henry Darger.
Throw a Mos Tolliver in there, if you will.
Mos Tolliver, for sure. I mean, you know you're outsiders. And if you hung them in their period next to Mondrian, next to Pollock, they wouldn't ruin art history in the same way Hilma af Klint does not destroy, Kandinsky, who was wearing a little thin. Sorry, Kandinsky fans.
We're speaking to Jerry Saltz about the 10 best art shows. Number two is LaToya Ruby Frazier.
Wow.
It was at Gavin Brown's Enterprise up in the Harlem.
Yeah.
Up in the Harlem. He has different locations. They're different locations, right?
They do, but the biggest by far is the huge building that he opened in Harlem in 126th Street near Broadway. And Gavin Brown Gallery was a very hip, hot, is a very hip, hot gallery showing mainstream artists, Chris Ofili, Peter Doig, etc., etc. Brown moves up there because of the crisis in Chelsea around space being too expensive. And his gallery has accidentally been reinvented. Half of the people I see when I go up there are people of color. And they almost seem to be programming the gallery. And I don't say that figuratively. Mm-hmm. They come in with ideas. And the people that Gavin hired from the neighborhood are listening. And he's just programming shows now. And the big problem he will have is two, if I may. One is big wig curators who fly to Hong Kong and to Basel and to Miami Beach to go to wonderful, cute art fairs. They will go around the world, but they can't make it up to
uptown.
Isn't that weird? So he's having a hard time getting the big wigs there and hard time selling this work. This show that you mentioned, LaToya Ruby Frazier, got a MacArthur in, I think, 2006. She documents the water crisis in Flint, the ongoing water crisis, and in her hometown in Pennsylvania. She herself has lupus. Her mother was diagnosed with cancer, put in a hospital, and then kicked out of the hospital because she was black and too poor and yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And these are great shows.
The photographs, it's not only art. There's a sense of journalism to them, I think.
For sure.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me that the only people who have covered, really, the Trump disaster for me and my side is the news. I would love to see more artists on that story, not just CNN and PBS. I love seeing your pictures of that, but in the old days, artists used to go to the South and follow the civil rights thing or whatever they followed, gay rights, anything. Artists, get down there. Start shooting your relatives who voted for Trump. Just let's see it so when it's over, you bring it back alive as a reminder.
I'm curious about your thoughts. You know, if you put in Gavin Brown Enterprises and Harlem, you will get articles that talk about gentrification, and this is a problematic, the favorite word of everyone, problematic.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
It is problematic. It is hard. Everywhere, especially art goes, money seems to follow, and once money follows, well, you know all the rest.
Right.
Will there be a bunch of galleries up there to displace people? I hope not. Could it happen? It could. Right now, it hasn't. I also think that the phase that we're in with all this money and all of our concentration on 33 very rich, white, famous male painters bought and sold by 55 very rich people, all of that might pass in the next 5 years. And when the chips fall, we'll be able to look at them and say, where were you while we were getting high? And there will be a few galleries, I hope, in Harlem.
We're speaking with, oh, go ahead.
Please.
I was going to tell people who they were listening to. Jerry Saltz from New York Magazine. He's walking down the 10 best art shows. If you'd like to join the conversation, or you can always ask Jerry a question, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. I have it number three for you, Robert Gober. Am I saying that correctly?
Let me jump down to number 10 so we don't miss it.
Yes.
I'm going to be obnoxious. There was an impossible commission given this year by President Obama and the First Lady Michelle Obama. There's no way to succeed at this. And yet, Kehinde Wiley and Amy Sherald, am I pronouncing her name right? I put her into a show in Washington, D.C., where she was discovered. I was on a jury. He painted the president. She painted the first lady. And against all odds, these paintings broke through to the public that could see them, could see that they were different, that they were modern, that they were good, that they were respectful, and also about the dignity of these two people. And if you go to the portrait gallery, these paintings will really stand out now as really special, really special.
Kehinde Wiley sat in that chair.
Wow, what did he say?
2 months ago.
Yeah.
Because he's got this event at St. Louis Art Museum, where he went to St. Louis. You know, his part of his work and his mission is he meets people on the street and they come in and he paints the people of the city and the people of the town. He really wanted to address some of, you know, St. Louis is so segregated.
Amen.
And he also painted someone who works here.
Who? Can't say.
I can say.
Who?
Can
Everybody's
I say?
Everybody's looking around the booths. There's signs being thrown up. Well, anyway,
it's a beautiful painting.
Here.
Yes.
Right.
And he was wonderful. You know, he really talked about, he talked about color a lot. He talked about dignity. That was one of the ones that came up a lot.
He's on a mission. He's a painter on his mission. I don't love all of his work, but my God, he delivered on this impossible thing. And the backdrop of this, not just our politics, has been a lot of bad optics, I want to say.
Oh, yes.
And on all different levels, there's the money that it makes it so the public listening to me now thinks, oh, Jerry, he's part of the machine. Or every gallery that everyone walks into, they'll go, oh, the money. I just have to remind you that about 1% of 1% of 1% of artists make any money. The other 99.9 are somehow getting by. And we can't just see through the filter of money. There were the really bad optics of my beloved Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Met, who, oh God, then first they started having an apartheid-like admissions policy based on, it's like gerrymandering the museum, where you live. And I don't know. I think that everybody listening to me, if you'd be a good art viewer, if you will sneak in to the Met. You must do this for me. Get a fake ID. Get a student ID. Have your friend get the real one and slip it back under. And I've asked the Met people. I've said, you know this is terrible optics. And they go, yeah. And I say, you better not be really stopping and carding people. And they went, nah, everybody can get through. So I'm blowing their cover right here.
You may remember, think of something years and years and years ago. I dated an artist back when Williamsburg, when nobody went to Williamsburg, and he lived in like an old renovated church. We had to pull up the door to get in. And we would go to the Met, and he would pay a quarter.
See?
Just out of protest.
Well, I paid either a dollar or a quarter, and it was good because there's a lot of 99% of the people can't afford it, and they don't survive just on that, and they, well, And there were bad optics around the country. Other curators, activist curators, getting fired from MoCA out in L.A., and then they lost their director. It just kind of went on. So the backdrop to art is of people thinking it's in crisis. And I want to say to you and your audience, art is doing just fine. It's true that it's harder than ever, especially in a great city like this, a New York real estate market where we all live in a dump. I, too, live in a dump, artists. But we're going to be just fine. The big galleries, they're going to live. You can't get rid of them. They're like the Death Star, right? And some of them are great, and don't badmouth them. But make it your business, please, people listening to this show, to go to galleries. That's where you show love. That's where you see your culture. That's where you find out what your taste is.
Let's take a couple of calls. Number four, Christopher in Astoria saw a show.
Yes.
You liked a bunch?
Yes. Hello. Yeah. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I went to a great show recently at Brooklyn Museum to see Soul of a Nation.
Ah.
And I really recommend that people go to that showing. It's, you know, Brooklyn Museum is pay what you wish.
Amen.
And I missed the showing when it was at the Tate. When I was in London, it was there at the time. And I'm really glad that it came to Brooklyn Museum. Hendrix Barkley has some great paintings.
So it's a show. It's a show of 1960s pre-conceptual art from artists of color. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's just an amazing show. The paintings are incredible. It's like two floors, tons of paintings.
So what did you see? What else did you see that you want to mention?
Recently I also went to go to MoMA.
Yeah.
I saw a great show. What's the artist? Something Charles White.
Oh, that's amazing.
Right.
Another great exhibit. And then, yeah, as you said,
another artist of color that had been a little bit passed over. I think he was the teacher of Kerry James Marshall.
He was, yes.
And
absolutely.
Married to Elizabeth Catlett. At one point
my
in his life.
My God.
Oh, I didn't know
and
that.
By the way, Christopher, we've had the curators of both of those shows on All of It. So when you get home, Google.
Boom.
And listen in.
I will.
All right.
We got. Thank you so much.
Sure, Jerry. You got a fan on line three. He says, Jerry is right on.
Yeah.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
What's going on?
Hi, Jerry. I just wanted to compliment you on your article in New York Magazine. I'm an artist, and I have a partner, and we just opened a gallery in Long Island City, and we're featuring some artists that you've actually reviewed in the past.
Get out. Name me one.
Well, the curator is Nicholas Cueva.
Uh-huh. And he's great. A great artist.
Yeah, and he's a lovely guy.
Yeah.
And we have work by Amanda Baldwin and Georgia Elrod and Jess Willa.
Okay, give your own gallery a shout out, please.
Okay, the gallery is called 550 Gallery. It's in Long Island City, one stop from Grand Central Station to the Vernon Jackson exit.
Okay.
But I didn't call to give myself a plug.
Okay.
I just called to really compliment you. I've given your article to all kinds of musicians.
You mean the How to Be an Artist?
Huh?
The article was How to Be an Artist?
Well, it applies to anybody who loves art and wants a deeper understanding. I've been an artist since I'm 70 years old now. And I've been an artist. I've had some successes. And, you know, I managed to make a career of it. But it is so right on that you're pretty much destined to be poor the rest of your life. But the payback, the engagement, the understanding that it feeds your soul, and it's something you have to pursue no matter what. You know, you cannot not stop. And engaging with other artists now that we have a gallery is even better. But it was your art. Just a terrific article. It's just totally right on.
Okay. Right. We're going to try to get out to 550. Is that the hell's name of the gallery?
550 Gallery.
In Long Island City.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Charles. Is that what your name was?
I'm Daniel Sinclair.
Daniel. Okay, Daniel Sinclair, we'll see you soon.
Very good. Thanks again.
All right. So, Jerry, we've got about 2 minutes left. I'm going to let you free skate.
Oh, my God.
When you think back on 2018 and art, we'll just go.
What I'm thinking is a lot of artists worry, am I political enough? My answer to all of you is, yes, you are. Even if you're only painting watercolors or still lifes, the content of now is in your work because you're living now, or the rejection of now is in your work because you're living now. Some people's answer to what's going on is to make something beautiful or truthful. I would tell you that if you make art that is only in a good cause, that does not make your art good. You must find a way to find your voice, redefine skill, be original, be radically vulnerable. You can't just paint a picture of Trump's, you know, mouth and go, bad, bad. You know what I would say to you? That's simply a generic political poster. And get a life. I would rather you paint a still life, for God's sake. It would be more honest from you. So where is art now? Art is doing great. That guy that just called shows you how porous New York is. Mm-hmm. It isn't over. It isn't impossible. You men, you have to man up. Women, you have to woman up. Everybody has to just get to work, work, work. Don't be a baby. Make an enemy of envy. Stop looking at everybody else. Like, oh, they have it better than me. Their ankles are thinner. I don't care, frankly. Just get to work. Make it out of yourself. And don't bother me too much when you see me in person, but say hi, for God's sake. I'm just as lonely as you, and I love being on this show.
Three things. One, the Charles White exhibit is up until the 13th of January at MoMA. Go see it. Two, our colleague, we can say his name now, Darnell Jefferson. He was painted by Kehinde Wiley, St. Dionysus. Go look it up. And three, Jerry Saltz. We love it when you're here.
Oh, God, I love it, too.
Jerry Saltz, he's a senior art critic at New York Magazine. Coming up next, we're talking with Sarah Holdren, New York Magazine's theater critic, about her favorite plays of the year. Don't go away. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC, and this is a very special day for us. Throughout the show, we've been collaborating with our friends at New York Magazine and taking your calls to create the ultimate year-end art and culture list of TV, movie, music, books, art shows, and now theater. Whether you're an avid theater goer or an exhausted holiday host just looking for an activity for the whole family, we hear it all of it. And New York Magazine, we have you covered. Vulture's theater critic Sarah Holdren, who's seen a whopping 142 shows and counting, writes that nearly all of the productions of 2018 were bold, inventive, and loud. That's my favorite thing. Sarah, welcome to All of It.
Hi, thanks so much.
All right, we were saying right before we came in the air, you said there was one more show and it just didn't make deadline and it would be on my list if I could have. So let's give that show a shout out.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it came up right after this thing had to be filed. But there's a show at New York Theater Workshop right now called Slave Play by Jeremy O'Harris.
Oh, I've heard about
that. Yeah, it's gotten a lot of, incredibly deserved buzz. And really, it's a bit hard to talk about. When I filed my review, I kind of said, don't read this until you see it, because it really is that rare thing that you don't want to have spoiled. You know, I mean, you can say spoiler alert and talk about it, but it is surprising. It's fierce. It really goes fascinating places, and you do not expect what it's going to do. You know, they advertise it as a play about sort of sex and violence and race in the antebellum South. This is what is on the poster. It goes many places other than that. So it's a fascinating piece.
All right. We'll call it the asterisk to your top 10.
Yeah, exactly.
Top 10 list. I've been asking everybody, in terms of whatever their beat is, what did a play or a piece of theater need to make it to your list this year?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think for me, I respond to things that I find courageous in some way. I think I respond to things that I feel like are making some kind of truly intimate and also bold declaration of who the artist is that's at work, right? Like, it's so interesting. I really love Russian theater, and I love Russian theater pedagogy, and there's this kind of wonderful phrase that is used by Russian directors and authors. I mean, it's very emotional. It's very sort of heightened, but they talk about the author's suffering and the director's scream, and so it's, you know, really, it's these big, big emotional phrases phrases about what's at the heart of a piece, right? Like, what is the author suffering over at the heart of this play? And then what does the director have to kind of scream about in response to that question? And when I feel like I really can identify a brave central question and someone, you know, bravely stepping out to respond to that question, then I get really excited.
And that's very interesting, because when I think about that now and I look at your list, I understand why you have certain plays that have already been staged.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely I'm a person who really appreciates classics, and especially when they're kind of revisited and sort of torn apart to a certain mm-hmm. extent. So that's why you'll see something like the Daniel Fish directed revival of Oklahoma on my list, which is actually going to be on Broadway. It's going to transfer to Circle in the Square. Yeah. So that's a really exciting opportunity for more people, I think, to experience that production, which is really, I mean, for my money, that production is kind of what's been inside Oklahoma all along, you know, like this really, like it's still full of beautiful music and it still makes you laugh. And there's something at the same time that's just really unsettling that I believe is truly in the play and really in the fabric of, well, of the country, which is what the play is about. It's about sort of a birth of the country in a way. So that play, I think, I'm so glad that it has another life coming for it after St. Anne's, where it was.
Yeah, it's dark and twisted. We actually had the three female leads here.
Yes,
and also the race blind casting mm-hmm. and the casting of some of Ado Annie, the woman Ally Stroker uses a wheelchair.
Yes.
It was just and also used to great effect.
Like yes.
It was just a really interesting staging. So that's your only musical, right? On your top 10?
I think that might be right.
What was going on with musicals this year?
You know, that's funny. I mean, that might be just my own. I find it really difficult to put these lists together, to be perfectly honest. But, no, I really do. I mean, I think I wrote something in the introduction to this one that said it felt like comparing, I think I said apples and astronauts, you know? So, but that really is how it feels to me. You know, it comes to the end of a year and you go over the things that really struck you. And sometimes it feels like, how am I supposed to, you know, how am I supposed to put, say, for instance, something like The Prom, which is a musical that's running on Broadway right now, that I think is, you know, it could not be more charming. And I think it's doing what it sets out to do incredibly well. And also, how am I supposed to sort of hold it up and say, you know, yes, I can judge this on the same spectrum that I talk about, for instance, you know, this play Yerma that's on my list that's, you know, incredibly dark and takes place in a glass box.
Yeah,
and,
tell us about Yerma. I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, so Yerma came to the Park Avenue Armory and was kind of came, you know, trailing these sort of clouds of like, you know, Simon Stone has really blown this production open. This is an older, you know, it's by Lorca, so it's a quite an old play. But this adaptation really, to me, it kind of made this story work in the context of a modernity where we feel both completely isolated and also like we're constantly being watched by our devices and, you know, and sort of have this feeling of needing to report on our entire life to the world through our devices and needing to receive the world's feedback through those things. And so this is the old story, the really almost sort of mythological tragedy that Lorca is writing is this play about a woman who kind of who wants a baby so badly that she sort of descends into madness. But really, in the end, I mean, it's not about a baby. It's about this huge, you know, this gaping, unsatisfied longing inside of a human being. And the way that Simon Stone and Billy Parker, the actress, and also the designers for that show, who really kind of, you know, this, she literally was inside a glass box, and the way particularly the sound design for that show worked, where everybody, the breathing, even when people's mouths moved, when that, you know, you could hear all of these sort of intimate body sounds, and it felt like I'm too close to these people. I'm uncomfortably close to them. And yet at the same time, I'm outside this glass wall, you know? So it was that kind of striking juxtaposition of being so keyed into everyone's private lives and at the same time so isolated, so lonely.
We're talking to Sarah Holdren, Vulture's theater critic, about the best productions, theater productions of 2018. If you'd like to weigh in, if you saw something that just blew your mind that was fabulous, give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We're bouncing around, but that's okay. Let's look at travesties.
Sure. Yeah. I was so delighted to see this play revived. Mm-hmm. This has been a play that's meant a lot to me for a really long time. And honestly, I think it's been interesting, actually. There's been a couple of stoppards in New York this year because Lincoln Center is currently doing The Hard Problem. And it's been fascinating for me to kind of think about stoppard again. I think that, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with people who, you know, I find that Stoppard sometimes tends to be a rather divisive playwright in terms of people's response to him. You know, you have some people who just adore his work, and then you have some people who are kind of like, I don't know, it seems really cold, it seems intellectual, it seems detached. Like, yes, it's funny, but it's funny in a very kind of, you know, haha, look at me, I'm so witty type of way. And I sort of believe firmly that that can happen to his plays mm-hmm. in production. And yet, if you're really kind of digging into what's there, the heart that's under the wit, I just believe there's so much else to be mined. And that production of Travesties, I just found, for one thing, it had a really brilliant director, also a playwright, Patrick Marber, who I think really just understood not only the humor of that play, but actually the pathos of it, and the fact that it's not just about these kind of wild flights of fancy and this kind of these artists sort of gallivanting about World War I Switzerland, but it's also about art and all of the things art can be other than a social critique, right? Like I was just listening to Jerry in here with you, and I'm firmly with him, right? Mm-hmm. You know, this idea that we can't say all art is there for is to tell us how to be politically good, and if it's not telling us how to do that, then the art itself is not good.
You don't like the preach play.
Yeah,
you were not a fan of American Son.
Yes, there might have been an article written about that. Yes, I really do have a. I really tend to balk when I feel like something is kind of grappling, like sort of attaching a grappling hook to an issue that is of no doubt important, but at the same time, I don't know what this piece of theater is giving me that I couldn't get from a well-written article, a well-done documentary. I feel like, and I also think that a lot of these plays are kind of trying to exhibit a moral stance rather than to get us to question as audience members, well, how should I move through the world? I think they don't leave us with questions, really. They leave us with kind of certainties or even just sort of feelings of...
I said just dealing with the feelings.
Yeah, well, and honestly, to me, a lot of times, you know, feelings that are somewhere between guilt and boredom, you know, these things that we don't really like to admit that we have when we go to the theater. You know, I think, I mean, honestly, you know, for my, the theater is so too expensive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
I know it is. It's a luxury good when it shouldn't be 99% of the time. And, you know, I think people, I've been at shows where, you know, I've heard audience members turn to each other at intermission and sort of say questioningly, you know, with a question mark on the end of the sentence, this is good, right?
Or was this worth a ticket?
Yeah, this is good. And they're trying to convince themselves. Yeah. You know, it's like no one wants to think, you know, I put all of these resources into something and now I have to, you know, and now I have to grapple with the fact that, you know, this really isn't great. And I think, you know, this Kurt Vonnegut quote, right? He's got these amazing rules for writing. I think the very first one is, whatever you do, do not waste your audience's time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I want to sneak in one call and get to number one. Andrea, on line one from Riverdale, you saw something you loved.
Yes, I saw Fiddler in Yiddish.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
It's fantastic. It's also very minimalistic because there are very few props on the stage, like the fiddler is standing on top of the roof, but it's actually just a bunch of tables and chairs. And,
yes.
Also, I think that it's very topical now with all the hatred out there, and that's the theme of the play.
It's a gorgeous show. I think you're right. I mean, it was such a beautiful thing to see interpreted in well, really its home language, it feels like. And I think you're right about the really stripped-down approach to it.
Also, the fact that they had the surtitles Oh, be quiet, dog. The Search Girl in English and in Russian.
That's mm-hmm. so cool. Andrea, thank you so much for calling. We got about a minute left, so I'm going to ask you to like three adjectives for your number one.
Sure.
Your number one, we had lovely Heidi Schreck on our show. What the Constitution
yes.
means to me. A couple adjectives, why this
adjectives.
Is
adjectives. Well, unfortunately, I'm going to have to repeat myself again and say
okay.
and say courageous. And I'm going to say personal. And I'm going to say honest. I just think it's a beautiful piece that really manages to take a personal story and crack it open to something so much bigger than that.
Sarah Holdren is Vultures Theater critic. Thank you so much for coming in for our big mashup show.
Of course.
Really appreciate it. You've been listening to All of It on WNYC, our best of year end up mashup show with New York Magazine. Big thanks to everyone from New York Magazine who came in to make this possible. I'm Allison Stewart. This is All of It on WNYC. We will see you next time.